This is John Rotherer, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 31st of January, 2013. John Rotherer, Part 2.
Most of your surveying you are using theodolites, but did the telerometer come in towards the end of your time, and if so, was it a great advance?
It was never used, as far as I know, by any fit surveyor in my day, in that time, 1958, or 56 to 59. No, I don't remember. I do remember that the Royal Navy were using them.
And why were they so much better than what you had?
Well, I think in those days that the FIDS was really run on a shoestring. It really was. Whereas the Royal Navy, of course, would be well equipped. And I think that's it, really.
So they were available, but the FIDS couldn't
afford them. Oh, they must have been available, yes. Mm. Yes.
Were they a struggle, theodolites?
I think you've got to know how to use them. But when you put them up on the tripod and so on, you've got to level everything beautifully. And then it's pretty cold working the actual knobs and so on, especially if you're doing star observations at night. And it's bitterly cold then. You did have silk gloves, but even they were too much, really. They got in the way of the very fine manipulation you had to do on the wheels and so on.
So you take these theodolites out on your sledging trips?
Yes. Presumably. Yeah. Yes.
I've been asked to ask you if there was a particular memorable sledging trip, the one that went further, higher, farther.
Well,
one you were proud of particularly?
I think that one thing which was interesting was getting to the northern end of Labrador Fjord, a place called the Gullet, I think it was called. And as far as I know, only before our time, only one lot of people had managed to sledge through there. It was connecting Hernooster Bay to the north, the base W area, to Marguerite Bay to the south, through this very narrow gap on the east side of Adelaide Island. And when we went, when I was up there, we were able to sledge right into the gullet. It got a bit slushy, but we could, if we'd had the time and the inclination, have gone right through and to base W that way, which was quite remarkable. The problem was, I think, caused with the pressures of the sea to the north and the sea to the south in this very narrow gap, which made it, even in the good ice years, very difficult to get through.
It was all crumpled up, was it?
Yes, and it very slushy indeed.
Yeah.
You found your feet going through the ice.
When you lost those dogs down the crevasse, were you then reduced to a seven-dog team for the rest of the season?
No, I can't remember.
Okay.
Well, there may have been dogs. We were on the way to W, and I've got a feeling we had two replacement dogs at W, but I can't quite recall that.
You don't remember that the sledging or surveying programmes were affected by the loss of the dogs?
They weren't at all, no. Yeah. No.
Okay. Tell me about this close shave with a helicopter.
Oh, yes. Well, that was... the helicopter came from San Martín. Well, actually, it came from an Argentinian icebreaker. Landed at our place.
At the Horseshoe?
At Horseshoe, on Back Bay, on the ice. And they were going back to the icebreaker, and then they're going to fly from the icebreaker to the General San Martín base. And they said one person could go with them. And we drew lots. Peter Gibbs drew the lot. He got back to the ship successfully and he got off on the ship. On the way, when the helicopter was flying from the ship to the base, the engine stopped. Well, something went wrong and it went straight into the water. And quite a number of them were drowned. But some were survived, two or three, I believe.
It's a chilling reminder, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is. But Argentinian equipment and so on, they were very superstitious people. We knew that. If they were going up onto the plateau from their base, which was not far north of Stonington Island, they were very superstitious about their chances of getting back. They set off in a frame of mind which wasn't really conducive to having a successful sledging trip. They expected something awful to happen every time.
You mean they were pessimistic?
They were pessimistic, yes. Very pessimistic people when it came to sledging.
How odd.
In fact, when I and my sledging partner, I can't remember who, were at San Martin on the way back to Horseshoe for Christmas, when we left, they didn't want us to leave, they wanted to stay another night, but we said, look, it's Christmas Eve tomorrow, we've got to get back. And they came with us with a kind of a tank with caterpillars, all on the sea ice, halfway to Horseshoe, or a third of the way to Horseshoe, before we all shook hands and they went off. Well, I gather, not long after that, that machine went through the ice and was lost forever.
One of the FIDs said to me the big difference between the FIDs and the Argentinians was that the FIDs wanted to be in the Antarctic and the Argentinians didn't.
Yes, that could be true.
Yeah. You sense that, did you?
Well, there was certainly a difference of the attitude, yes. Yes.
But they were very hospitable as well.
Very hospitable indeed. One of the good things you knew about going to their base was that they had steak, lots of steak, which was kept, if I recall it correctly, in an ice cave, because their base was actually connected to the mainland, as Toddington was, by ice and snow. And there was a cave there where they kept the steak. And we knew that if we went there, we'd get steak. Not exactly fresh, because it was frozen, but it was a darn sight better than what we got on our bases. Everything we had was dried or tinned.
And red wine?
I don't remember that.
You don't? Some bases had it, some others didn't, I gather.
I can't remember red wine, no. Well, I knew on our base, oddly enough, there was always plenty of drink. Well, not too much. At Christmas and midwinter, there was plenty of drink. And there was drink throughout the year, but not many of the people at Horseshoe drank very much. But I didn't really. I don't remember anybody ever drinking too much. Several of us smoked, I did in those days, because there was an enormous amount of cigarettes, there really was. Peter Gibbs smoked, I remember. But because there were so many cigarettes, sometimes you'd find yourself smoking two at once. I don't mean in your mouth, but you'd lick one and put it on an ashtray. And without thinking, you got another one out of the tin. There were these round tins, Players. I don't know whether you remember them, Chris, right. But they're all in round tins with a lid on. But some of us smoked a bit too much because a lot of people didn't smoke at all.
How would you relax? What would you do for recreation?
We would, when we were at Blakelocked, before the sea ice formed, we'd take our skis up the slope behind the refuge hut. And we'd try and ski down. But, of course, it was a long way back up, so you didn't do it more than, say, about twice. If we'd had a ski lift, it would have been much better. Also, most people read a lot. That's the main thing, I think. On base, well, sometimes you had to do the cooking, of course. But fortunately, I didn't, because I wasn't really on base that much. So we existed basically on the dog food. the sledging, iron rations in the, rations. In the boxes.
Yeah.
Pemmican, it was horrible stuff. The second year we got this meatloaf stuff, which was much better. Much better. Otherwise, there was always something happening. The dogs always needed looking after. As I say, you had to feed the dogs. And sometimes it was necessary to go and get seals to get the seal meat and so on. There's always something happening.
Were you also dealing with your survey results when you got back to base? Were you, having got the field work done in your yes. notebooks or whatever, well, tell me first of all, how did you record your measurements in the field?
Well, we recorded them in the survey books, but the work actually of compiling the results from those figures, we did not do until we got back to England to the directorate of, I think it was then Overseas Survey, I can't quite remember when the name changed, but we all went to Tolworth and worked there for a year, nearly a year anyway.
So you were working on your own results, you weren't packing?
Yes, no, nobody else did, no, no.
I can just imagine, it's probably my imagination running right, there you are back in jolly old England, going through your notebooks and missed one.
Oh yes, it's possible, yes. There was a lady there who was brilliant at, we had these German machines where you pushed levers down and so on. I can't remember what they called them, but it was quite a performance using those. But she always took the results from us that we worked on to begin with, and she worked on them again somewhere down in the directorate.
Comptometer?
It might be.
Yeah.
It was a black, very black, and lots of little levers.
Like kind of an adding machine.
Yes, that's right. It was. Mm.
So, but you weren't drawing maps yourself, though?
No, we weren't. We were going to be drawn by the cartographers at the directorate.
Were you looking at drafts of those maps to comment on them, or?
No, I don't think so.
So the first you knew was when the published map was released?
Well, the first I would know, they would send me a map now and again.
As a thank you?
Well, I suppose they just arrived. Over the years, several maps arrived, and then a map would arrive of when they put the name Rother on the point. They sent me a map of that with the name on it. I keep meaning to go to Sandford. Is it Sandford? Yes. In Longacre, the map people, to see what the latest situation is with the mapping. Because they must be quite brilliant now, the maps.
Yes.
Compared to our day.
Satellites help enormously, I believe.
Oh, yes. Yes. Mm.
You didn't sense, I think we did kind of touch on this before, but you didn't sense that your methods would soon become redundant with the advent of the satellite and the...
Not in those days.
Not as early as that.
I don't think we'd really got to the stage of satellite in any big way then. Mm. No. I think today, well, I don't know, but I'm glad I went there when I did, rather than in nowadays.
Why is that?
Well, it was more of an expedition, shall we say. Whereas now, I think I made the point, you can fly in and out of Rother at will. In our day, when the ship went from the last supplies, 9 months and no outside contact at all. And of course, in those days too, I think it was a lot more Antarctic than it is now. Mm. Because Jim Fellows told me when he came here that this Jones ice shelf we used to get from Blakelock to the mainland had disappeared. In fact, when he went on this ship, they actually sailed round Blakelock Island, which I thought, not very happy about that.
Yes, it does seem irreversible at present, doesn't it, that trip?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. So tell me then about the process by which this piece of land got called by your name. What was your story?
I did work, after we got back to England, myself and Peter Gibbs, we went for 2 or 3 weeks to the research department of the Foreign Office in Stamford Street on the South Bank. in those days, it wasn't like it is now, Southbank, vastly different. But I always remember being there. We'd been there a few days, and every morning and every afternoon, the lady would come with a tea trolley down this long corridor. It was a very basic building. And some people would come out of their rooms, men in woolly cardigans and so on. And I would remember one day, I'd never thought before, looking at the door of where they came from, as this one was Sir somebody so-and-so and so-and-so. My goodness, they don't look like they should do. Quite interesting. Now, the point was, we were working, looking at place names. There was a chap called Brian Roberts. I remember him very clearly, Brian Roberts. He was in charge of the British part of the place names programme. And I remember every name that was then put onto a map had to be agreed internationally. I didn't realise, nobody ever told me my name was going to be on that point until the map came through the post with a little note saying this is a Rotherham point. Nobody had ever approached me at all. But it was the policy I knew for all surveyors and geologists to have their name, or they tried to have their names, the authorities to put their name somewhere on the map.
As a kind of a memento, really?
Yes. Mm. In the area where you were working, not 1,000 miles away, 100 miles away, but in the area where you were actually doing the work.
So there was some inevitability that your name would appear somewhere in the Antarctic?
Yes, I suppose so. Although by the time it came here, I'd forgotten all about that kind of thing.
Oh, it was years later, was it?
Mm.
Okay. And then it was just sheer coincidence that site was chosen for the news.
Oh, yes, very much. I believe the base was supposed to be down at Alexanderland. But because of the ice conditions, they didn't get in. So they settled on what was then Rotherham Point. Although it was a very good location, as we had found at the time we were there, there was so much rocky area and the extent of it that you could have built a large base quite easily. Mm. But it never entered our heads there'd be a runway there. My goodness.
I've been asked to ask you what it's like to have an Antarctic base named after you.
Well, it's like sometimes the phone rings and said, put the television on. Your base is on the television. And that's when I say, but it isn't actually my base. It's only by chance they put the base at Rotherham Point. Whether, I don't know. I mean, they needn't have called it Rotherham Base, did they?
No.
They could have, it could have been Sir Vivian Fuchs Base or whatever. I don't understand how that happened or who made the decision in the end.
Yeah, interesting thought, isn't it? I suppose calling it after the piece of land that had already been named was a coward's way out, wasn't it?
Well, it was an easy way,
yeah,
yes.
There was no argument.
No.
Yeah. As one of the points made by Bass today is, it's a jolly good job you weren't called Pratt or Smelly.
yes. I think then probably it would have been Sir Vivian Fuchs Base or something like that.
So when did you begin to discover that they were going to actually build a base there?
I didn't know until they'd done it.
Oh, really?
I had no idea, no. The thing is, of course, once you leave the organisation, gradually it recedes into the background. And I got very much involved in Tiny Country planning. And most people in planning, they get immersed in it in the end.
Mm.
And they love doing it.
Just before we move on to your later career, your final connection was concerning the Antarctic Place Names Committee, which you were connected with when you were at the Research Department of the Foreign Office, is that correct?
Yes.
So what places, what names do you remember being awarded in your period there?
Oh, I don't think they were awarding names. I think we were just considering with Brian Roberts, and he had an assistant, lady assistant, she came from the Channel Islands. She never stopped smoking, I always remember that.
Mm.
Chain smoker. But we were only looking at maps, and we were not in any way deciding that this name shall go here and that shall go there.
So let's look at then what happened next with you, because having done those 2.5 to 3 years in the Antarctic, everyday life beckoned again, didn't it? When you were leaving the Antarctic, were you glad to get out or sorry to leave?
Well, curiously enough, that the end of the 2 years, in fact, it was 2.25 years, the ships were finding it difficult, our ships were finding it difficult to get to relieve our base because we were at Donington again, at Horseshoe. And there was a possibility that we weren't going to have a relief that year.
Oh, right.
But then we heard, they've got an American icebreaker. Then we heard, they've got 2 American icebreakers. And then it was 3. And sure enough, 3 turned up, and we were taken out by helicopter to the ice edge, American helicopter, and the Americans rescued us. Well, we were on the Bisco, but we wouldn't have been out without the Americans. And there was a feeling of, if they don't come, they don't come.
You were fairly sanguine about it.
And most people were.
An extra winter.
Nobody was desperate to get out.
So were you sorry to leave?
Sorry.
Were you sad?
In a way I was, but I thought 2 years is long enough, really. But it was sad to think possibly you'd never see that area again. And in those days, you weren't getting tourist ships going down, or very little.
Have you been back since?
No, I haven't, no.
What happened when you got back then, back to Blighty?
Well, I was a year at the Director of Overseas Survey, or I mean, it may have still been Colonial Survey. And then I went to Town and Country Planning, started in Dorset, at the Dorset County Council in Dorchester. But after a few years, moved here.
To Basingstoke?
Yes, to what was then called the Basingstoke Development Group. It was a special group put together of planners, architects, surveyors and other people. And our mission in life was to facilitate the expansion of Basingstoke to take London Eversville, both in housing and in factories and in office blocks and so on. And that was a very interesting period because there was loads of money for doing it. Mostly came from the government and the London County Council. So overnight, roads would suddenly appear and office developments would go up. And it was very interesting.
How did it compare to humping a theodolite up a snowy hill?
Totally different. Very different. Mm-hmm.
So you were sitting in your office on a winter's day and the snow would start outside. Were you transported back to...
Yes, the snow does make you think of that. Well, it does me anyway, yes. Mm. I love snow. I always have, though. When I was a schoolboy, I would trudge miles to school through thick snow to get to school. Basically, to be able to be out in the snow.
All right.
Yeah.
Did you find yourself using anything you'd gained or experienced or learned in your Antarctic years, in your later professional life? Were there skills or abilities that you picked up that came in handy later on?
I may have picked up a bit of diplomacy, because if you are living in on a base with... There were only 9 of us that first year. I remember one, there should have been 10, but somebody was taken back to Britain. I think there was some problem. It could have been a mental problem. I can't remember.
They did sometimes turn people around at Stanley.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. We didn't really have any... Most people were quite easygoing. Very easygoing. Microphone. But I think we did have one person who could not be awkward, but had definite views. He had the definite view, of course, we should not kill seals to provide dog food. It was totally wrong. and made his view very well known. And I think he went out with a rifle, and when he came back, the rifle was broken. So nobody could go out and shoot a seal from then onwards.
Right, that's interesting.
It is interesting.
And would that person, let's not name him, would he be kind of sent to Coventry by the rest of the base?
No, not at all, no.
So they embraced...
There was talk about, what does he think he's playing at and so on. But no, he wasn't sent to Coventry. Well, not as far as I know.
So his idiosyncrasy, is that the right word? Yes. Was embraced rather than rejected.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
How interesting.
Otherwise, I don't remember anybody being difficult at all. I suppose it's because of the selection procedure. I'm pretty certain about that.
You think people were sussed out or psyched out?
Yes, definitely, before they got there. Before they left England.
Yeah.
Basically, yes.
So was it a fairly smooth career then?
Well, it was really. I ended up as head of forward planning and design here at the Basingstoke Council. We were still expanding the town enormously, still are actually. I'm still involved. Not there, but I can't stop being the chairman of the Kempthorpe Residents Association. I've tried desperately to unload it, but nobody else will do it. But because of my planning background, I get caught up in all the planning things. And I've spent hours in the last few months on certain proposals at the northern end of Kempthorpe and all to the west here. A big problem with land purchased by the Hampshire and Basingstoke jointly to develop. And then they said, we're not going to build on that. And the landowner, who had already made a mint through selling the freehold, took them to the High Court last year, and he won. And they're now having to build thousands of houses west of Basingstoke. The council were accused of acting unlawfully and irrationally, which they were, of course. This caused a lot of problems in the council, particularly.
Life was so much simpler, wasn't it, on Blakelock?
Oh, it was, yes. It was. Yes.
Final question, John, if I may. How do you rate those Antarctic years in your life?
I would say very highly. Yes. Yes. You can never forget what you experienced and what you saw and so on. And I think also, I knew I was going to the Antarctic. I was still taken by surprise when I got there. How beautiful it was, really. And the colours, the blues and the... there's amazing purples in the ice and the icebergs and so on. You just tend to think, it's just white and black, but it isn't. There's a tremendous amount of colour in the Antarctic. And the other thing I think always stuck in my mind, in fact, when I came to the interview at the development group here to get the job, one of the questions was, what's your biggest impression then of the Antarctic? And I never thought of that. And I thought for a second, then I said, silence.
Silence.
Silence. As night. If you're outside at night in the Antarctic on a calm night, especially if there's a moon and so on, absolutely so quiet, it's unbelievable.
Do you think that your Antarctic experience counted for anything at the interviews for jobs in this country?
It may have helped with my first job in Dorchester, but afterwards I don't think so. I think you'll find there are people who think, gosh, you've been to the Antarctic and so on, and others couldn't care less about the Antarctic.
I think of Neil Armstrong at times like this, who stepped on the moon and he came back knowing that nothing could ever match that. I wonder whether you've kind of spent the rest of your life slightly in the shadow of that achievement.
Hmm. It could be to a certain extent, but I think because I was so immersed in what I was doing now in this country, that really for most of that you never thought about it. You would always go back to the Antarctic in your mind for some reason or other, but I wasn't going to work every day thinking, oh, I wish I was sledging up Bourgeoisville and so on. No.
It's been a real pleasure, John. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much indeed.